This webcast is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Steinway & Sons is a proud sponsor of Between the Keys, featuring Jed Distler. More information about Steinway & Sons, makers of handcrafted pianos since 1853, is available at www.steinway.com. This is Jed Distler, artist in residence for the Classical Network, and welcome to Between the Keys. It is a pleasure for me to welcome back Lisa Yue as our special guest this hour. She is a most distinctive pianist, as well as a much sought-out lecturer, a faculty member at the Manhattan School of Music, and the creator of a long-running and very imaginatively programmed concert series called The Lives of the Piano. The Aurora label has brought out a release on both DVD and Blu-ray formats that features her performances of four Beethoven sonatas, along with some very insightful commentary on her part. And I'm pleased that this release brings Lisa Yue back to Between the Keys. Lisa, thank you so much for being here.
Hi, Jed. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
I would like to start off with a selection from your DVD, the first movement from Beethoven's so-called Moonlight Sonata, the famous Adagio Sostenuto. Let's listen. Lisa Yue at the piano.
Thank you.
Lisa Yui performing Music of Beethoven, the Adagio Sostenuto from his Piano Sonata No. 14 in C sharp minor, Opus 27, No. 2, the Moonlight Sonata. Lisa, I'm curious, when did you first learn the Moonlight?
It was actually later in my life. This is a piece that everyone knows and you assume everyone has played. But then I realized when I was about 25 mm-hmm. years old, I realized, oh, I actually haven't heard this live in so many years.
Oh,
and mm-hmm. I suddenly wanted to play it. When I started learning it, I just realized how difficult this first movement was. Because if you played it too slowly, it becomes boring. If it's too fast,
Glib.
It's glib. Yeah, that's right. And so I found it to be an incredible challenge to find my own clear concept of this sonata.
Certainly, if you have to put a top 10 list together devoted to the greatest hits of the classical piano repertoire, this piece always pops up, especially the first movement.
Yeah.
And it's something that is kind of part of everybody's subconscious. So even if you haven't heard this music, mm-hmm. you've heard it.
This and Forlì's, right?
That's right. Yeah. And it's only the opening measures. The dee 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 dee. And it's always the
first. It always slows down.
It's always the first measures kind of broken up. Every kid, even kids who don't play the piano, somehow know how to mangle the opening of Forlì's. The same way that they used to do Heart and Soul.
No, but you know, there is a reason why these pieces are so very popular, right? I think subconsciously people are attracted to something, to a certain greatness in these works. And this first movement, certainly, I mean, yes, you're right. It's often, you know, in part of the Piano at Night or something's series that include, of course, Clair de Lune and so forth. But this piece, as you know, it was published as kind of three in one. There are three movements, and yet you have to play them without stopping, attacca. There's no pause between the movements. And so it's very important to understand that this slow first movement is only part of the emotional journey that one must take to create this three-sectioned piece.
Even though it is so often played and heard as an entity in itself,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
or it certainly used to be at one time. And what I think is interesting is that even though this music is so familiar and iconic in the first movement, mm-hmm. as you said, you found it difficult in certain ways, and it poses a lot of questions as far as tempo, and there's some controversial aspects to
yes.
it. Maybe you can talk about that a little bit.
Yes, I think the difficulty, it made my life more difficult in trying to find my concept of this work because it is so popular and I've heard it so many times. I heard the kind of the sappy Liberace version. And
he's not that savvy. He actually plays it pretty straight.
You're right, actually. it's quite a noble performance. But what I mean by that is there's background, you know, orchestra.
On the DVD, you give an interesting example that may provide the clue as to what Beethoven might have had in mind for this movement. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. if you don't mind, I'd like to play this clip.
The German poet Ludwig Rellstab saw in the first movement the moonlight reflecting off Lake Lucerne. Had Beethoven known this, fortunately he was dead 5 years before Rellstab coined this nickname, he probably would have roared in anger. This nickname probably did more harm than good in the correct interpretation of this first movement of the sonata. Moonlight implies something dreamy and romantic, whereas this music expresses something more tragic and funereal. In fact, there's a manuscript on which Beethoven jotted down a fragment from Mozart's opera Don Giovanni, the scene where the commendatore is killed by the Don. But Beethoven, curiously, wrote it down a half step higher than the original. Now, this triplet accompaniment combined with the single line melody makes it very, very similar to this opening movement of the C minor, C sharp minor sonata. If indeed Beethoven was inspired by the scene from Mozart's opera, it would support the theory that this first movement is indeed tragic and noble rather than dreamy and romantic and very, very slow.
Lisa Yui speaking from her Beethoven DVD, and this is very interesting when you play the music from Don Giovanni, the accompaniment, and that kind of gives a sense of what Beethoven may have had in mind for the tempo or the mood.
Absolutely. So this came from a lecture I heard of András Schiff describing Edwin Fischer's book on the Beethoven sonatas. Schiff mentions a book by Edwin Fischer where he apparently in a sketchbook of Beethoven's, he jotted this scene from Don Giovanni where Don Giovanni had killed the commendatore and then there is this funereal music that's being played. And Beethoven transposed this to C sharp minor. Yeah. And the accompaniment and the dotted rhythm of this so-called Moonlight Sonata is very, very similar to the scene from Don Giovanni. It gives a completely different interpretation of how the general public views this music, the moonlight. It's romantic, it's dreamy, it's a little sleepy. But in fact, perhaps it's supposed to be actually noble and funereal and tragic rather than romantic.
Well, let's listen to, I'm not going to play the entire movement in these performances, but what I thought is that I would play just the opening part of several performances that are slow and fast, yet convey very different feelings. So one performance that is notable for its very slow tempo for the first movement, some may say notoriously slow, is by the British pianist Solomon. Why don't we just listen to a little of this? That was the pianist Solomon. What I find interesting is that he's playing very slowly, but rhythmically it's very, very straightforward. And he is making his points through how he balances his hands and from dynamics and from articulation. Mm-hmm. And it's creating a very specific kind of sound world.
Yes. Obviously, I would never play it this slowly. For most people, I think if I hear a performance this slow, I would kind of fall asleep. But Solomon is always able to maintain this constant tension that somehow it's still moving, it's still beautiful, and there's a nobility to it. But still, I mean, Beethoven does market cut time. And this does not sound like cut time at all. It sounds like 4-4 to me. But, you know, he somehow manages to maintain the tension. And I would never say that this is a bad performance.
Here's a performance that's a little bit faster. It's still on the slow-ish side, but I'm wondering if it maintains the same tension. Thank you. That is Daniel Barenboim in his EMI recording from the 1960s. The tempo is a little faster than mm-hmm. Solomon's, but I'm not sure if it maintains the same tension. I don't know. What do you think?
No, there's a certain kind of a vanilla quality to it. No, and I'm a little surprised because, I mean, Barenboim is such a phenomenal pianist and a mind and so forth. And I'm surprised that he plays it as if it's also in 4-4. And Solomon, I mean, you know, he chose a slow tempo and he goes all the way, right? And so he creates a very still world and it's almost surreal in a way. If you choose a slow tempo, I think you should really stick with it.
Okay, now here's a similar tempo to Barenboim, but I think with a little bit of difference.
Interesting.
I think a lot more interesting than the Barenboim.
Yes.
That was Rudolf Serkin.
There's this instantaneous tension that you hear from the triplet, and every single triplet has a deliberate quality to it. There's a tension, you know, which is not there in the second recording, despite the fact that they're very similar in tempi. I do like to hear it in cut time, though. You know,
well,
I think it gives a completely different world to it when you play it in cut time.
Well, let's listen to this recording, which is definitely cut time. Well, that is definitely cut time, and that's twice as fast. That was a pianist who, I don't know if many listeners know the name, Frederick Lamond, who mm-hmm. was born in 1868. He died, I think, 1948. I'm sure I'll be corrected on that if I'm wrong. He studied with Franz Liszt, and he was kind of a Beethoven specialist, mm-hmm. and he recorded, I think, 8 Beethoven sonatas in the 1920s, and this recording mm-hmm. is from the 1920s. What I found interesting is that he doesn't follow the text per se, like as far as dynamics, phrasing, mm-hmm. the way that like somebody like Arthur Schnabel might, mm-hmm. who's mm-hmm. a younger quote-unquote historic pianist, or Ignaz Friedman, yet it moves and it has such shape and specificity to it, I think.
Certainly, when you take it at a kind of a faster pace, the mood completely changes and it takes on a much more operatic quality.
Interesting that you say that. Operatic. Yeah.
The dotted rhythm becomes much more noble. First of all, we have to try to get rid of the nickname Moonlight from our heads, because this nickname was not given by Beethoven. It was dubbed by the critic Rellstab, who saw in the first movement the moonlight reflecting over Lake Lucerne. And this is something probably, I mean, Beethoven would have rolled over his grave over and over again. If we get rid of this kind of romantic, dreamy notion of this first movement, I think what reveals, the music itself will reveal to be something much more noble and much more operatic. And this idea of the connection with the Don Giovanni scene is, even if it's not true, I find that to be a very, very good point of reference in understanding this first movement.
Here's another one that is on the fast side. Very beautiful. Yeah, it's not as fast, obviously, as Frederick Lemann, but this is the Russian pianist Maria Grinberg, who recorded all of the Beethoven sonatas for Melodia. It's a wonderful set of recordings. And even though it isn't as fast, it still suggests the cut time.
And it's the first time that we hear that top, the repeated note melody, so glowing, so beautifully ringing over that triplet accompaniment.
As if she's not afraid to bring it out.
It has
that real projection of melody. Mm-hmm. It's which is something that I don't want to say that it's typical of Russian pianists, because that's kind of a stereotypical thing to say. But I have noticed that even in performances that are very different, like Emil Gilels, for instance, and also in this performance by Vladimir Horowitz. Again, it's slow, but the feeling of the cut time is there. That's Vladimir Horowitz, recorded in his home in the mid-50s.
Comes to show, I mean, it really shows that meter does not necessarily have to do with the speed of how you play it. And this is the first time that, of the recordings we heard today, that the bass is so rich. You know, I notice it for the first time. And whereas Grinberg's melody was kind of fat and golden, this one is more of a cry, and it's tender, and it's almost like a weeping.
It's multi-dimensional. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if the bass has to do with having a grand piano recorded in a New York townhouse, and also maybe the quality of his Steinway. I'm curious to compare it to a live Horowitz performance from the 1940s.
Do that.
Vladimir Horowitz live, similar concept, mm-hmm. but I don't think it has the concentration of the one he recorded in his home under studio conditions.
When the melody appears for the first time, I mean, in the first version at home, I was genuinely surprised by the sound that he entered it with. But the concept is pretty much the same between the two performances. I do prefer the first one, though.
But it's interesting how all of these pianists approach this piece so differently. What
yes.
a variety. And it's a little surprising and, yes. and maybe disconcerting.
I am completely open to any interpretation that seems to work for me. But for me, the aha moment was with the word tragic. Once that word popped into my head, the tempo changed, the sound quality changed. I wasn't as afraid to play a richer melody and a richer bass. Mm-hmm. And I think I was before because I was kind of locked into this moonlight concept. And the music itself did not reflect that kind of romanticism.
There's a performance that I find very interesting that is played on a period instrument of Beethoven's mm-hmm. time with the late Igor Kipnis. And this is something that I think is open to debate. Let's just listen to a little bit of this performance because I'd like your thoughts on the use of the pedal mm-hmm. in this movement. Actually, I'm kind of sorry I played that recording. I'm not sorry. I Igor Kipnis was one of the greatest harpsichordists who ever lived, but I'm not crazy about this instrument, but I selected this because there are all these little overlapping pedals, mm-hmm. all this kind of bleed through. It's kind of like if you have Xerox prints and there's smudges or something. But the reason I put this on is that the use of how much overlapping mm-hmm. pedal is mm-hmm. very open to debate. I'm wondering yes. why.
Beethoven indicate, actually the manuscript of the sonata exists except for the first page, right? So we can only rely on the first edition for what Beethoven wrote in regards to the pedaling. And he wrote apparently to be played very delicately throughout and with senza sordino, which means without pedal. I'm sorry. And he wrote senza sordino, which means with pedal throughout.
With pedal, yes.
With pedal. So we have pianists such as, well, if it was played on a forte piano, even if you use the pedal and leave it down for the entire movement, the decay was so fast that it would not muddy the harmonies completely. It would just create this very nice haze that which we heard in this Kipnis recording. But then what do we do on the piano? So we have pianists such as András Schiff, who says we have to keep the pedal down because that's what Beethoven says. And so his recording of this first movement is quite muddy.
Let's hear a little bit of that. Thank you. was Andras Schiff in the Adagio Sostenuto. That
my interpretation of what Beethoven wrote to be used, to be played with pedal throughout. That does not necessarily mean press the pedal in the beginning and don't take it off until the end. It means use pedal. So I do use pedal, and I do somewhat blur the harmonies over each other so that it creates this kind of a glow. But I don't think it's necessary to mush up all the harmonies together throughout the entire movement.
I think you have to use your ears as much as you use your fingers.
That's right, and not simply your eyes and blindly follow what you write. It has to sound good, right? Beethoven indicated pedal quite often in his sonatas, and he only indicates pedal when he wants a special effect.
Let's go to the second movement. It's a movement that's shorter, it's lighter in quality, and it almost doesn't seem pianistic in terms of how the voices move. It's very compact kind of writing that it almost reminds me of something that could be for string quartet maybe a piece for a small wind ensemble. Mm-hmm. I love this movement. So what I thought we could do is listen to two very different performances of it and hear the whole performance because it's just so damn short. Here's the first pianist. Since we heard Vladimir Horowitz a moment ago, why don't we listen to him in this movement? Vladimir Horowitz playing the second movement of Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata. That's a live performance from Carnegie Hall. Very interesting performance.
How wonderful is that? Yes. It's so unaffected. It's so not prissy, and yet so much going on, right? There's some a wonderful drone bass that surprises us in the trio section. A kind of a lightness and a sense of humor to it as well.
I also think that for all the little cute pianistic effects, the drops and dynamics and for lack of a better word, tricky phrasings, you really get a sense that it's beyond the piano. Again, what I was saying before about a string quartet, the trio, you could almost hear the voices, the interplay of voices between each string instrument.
Yes, he plays as almost as if there are no hammers. It's almost like he glides through the entire movement.
There's a real transparency about it, and the rubato is very, very subtle. And this combination of subtle freedom and a forward momentum that I'm wondering if the Toscanini influence of his father-in-law informs this.
It's very possible. I mean, with Toscanini, I kind of imagine a certain hardness or rigidity as well, which Horowitz does not reveal. But the tightness perhaps is an influence of his father-in-law.
The tightness, but also that the accents do not fall in predictable places.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you get that often in scherzos and mm-hmm. Toscanini Beethoven symphony performances where there's no cliche about them.
Right, right.
Now let's hear another performance that is completely different, yet also has this multi-dimensional character. Very interesting performance.
Very different.
That was Misha Dichter.
So, I mean, you can definitely hear clearly his ideas, such as, you know, this idea of the right-hand top melody being responded by the bass and the second half of the melody. And it's a very well-thought-out, intelligent performance.
Perhaps a little studied.
A little, yes.
I get a sense that you really hear the planning. Uh-huh. And whereas the Horowitz, I'm sure, was very planned, yet mm-hmm. it seems a little more organic, and it's not just because of the faster tempo.
Coming back to this idea of the three in one, the fact that Beethoven is asking the performers to not stop between the movements, we have to really consider the emotional development between movements one and two. And for me, the first movement is such repressed sadness. And this second movement to me has to be like opening the window and feeling the breeze and finally we could breathe.
But it's opening the window because there's a storm up ahead.
that's right. It's a little bit of a calm before the storm.
Exactly. You know, which mm-hmm. we get in the Pastoral Symphony of
yes.
Beethoven.
So the idea is, what kind of breeze does the pianist feel? With Horowitz, there's this wonderfully refreshing breeze that we heard, and then a country dance-like trio. And there's real joy in that second movement, which is kind of the way I hear this second movement, and it prepares us for the explosion of the final movement.
Now, the explosion in the final movement can be an onslaught, yet I think that, as you do, as we are going to hear very shortly, helps if you use very little pedal.
I think so. I mean, it's a little scarier for the pianist, but I think it makes it much more effective that way.
Because I think it makes a smoother transition from what came before,
mm-hmm.
because it's very soft, but then you have these hard-hitting accents, and then you have a place to build from.
Yes.
And I think you do this fantastically
in
your recording, and we are going to hear now the finale from Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata, performed by Lisa Yui.
Thank you.
That was the finale from Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata in C sharp minor, Sonata number 14, Opus 27, number 2. The pianist was Lisa Yui, who has been our guest this hour on Between the Keys. And that comes from a release on the Aurora label. It is a combination DVD and Blu-ray set of discs featuring video performances of four Beethoven sonatas, as well as commentary by Lisa Yui. It contains the Moonlight, the Appassionata, and the Waldstein sonatas, and the F major sonata, Opus 10, number 2. We have time for some more music, so before I play your performance of the first movement of Opus 10, number 2, I want to ask you what led you to include this sonata among the other three sonatas, which are very familiar and have nicknames, whereas the Opus 10, number 2 in F major is relatively unknown. Of course, it's not unknown because it's performed and recorded, but it doesn't have the same profile or cachet as the others, yet it's an absolutely wonderful piece. So what led to your including it?
I had several reasons, one being I simply love this sonata, and it's a masterpiece of timing and textures and humor, which he acquired from his teacher, Haydn. In terms of programming, the Opus 53 and 57, the Waldstein and the Appassionata, were kind of natural pairs. And the Moonlight added a kind of an earlier work, also tragic. And it balanced, the Opus 10, number 2 in F major balanced out, I thought, quite well in key and in character with the Appassionata, which is in F minor. Mm-hmm. And there are such complete polar opposites in duration and in character. And I thought it would be a very good addition to this rather heavy program.
Thank you.
Lisa Yui performing Music of Beethoven, the first movement of the F major sonata, Opus 10, number 2. Do you see yourself eventually programming or recording all of the Beethoven's?
Not sure. I used to play quite regularly for Leonid Hambro, who was Victor Borge's partner. He was a pianist for the New York Phil. Once I asked him, Lee, you must have played the Hammerklavier, the Opus 106, which is, you know, the kind of the Mount Everest of the Beethoven sonatas.
Yeah.
And I was honestly surprised when he said no. And he looked a little bored about it. He said no. And then I said, why? I mean, I think you would have played it wonderful. And he goes, too much work. And that was actually a profound, you know, response, because he probably would have preferred to study, I don't know, all three Opus 31s than to have to struggle and practice the fugue and all these runs and so forth. And so I have no, that was a very long response to your question, but I want to basically tackle the sonatas that really attract me for now, and I don't feel necessarily a pressure to learn all of them for now.
Anyway, I thank you so much for coming by on Between the Keys.
Thank you so much, Jed. It's always a wonderful pleasure to be on your show.
This is Jed Distler, artist in residence for the Classical Network, and thank you so much for listening. I look forward to being with you this time next week. Between the Keys, sponsored by Steinway & Sons, is an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.